You could start just by telling me when you came here and what you started working with, things like that.
I think I came in the fall of 83 or so. And at that time I was supposed to work on a new beamline here on Aladdin. But it turned out that that thing was not working.
Yeah.
It wasn't even close to be functioning. So so that's when I had a little bit of time set aside to do experiments over on Tantalus. And they were experiments all related to catalysis and surface reactions with certain gases and so on.
Okay.
And this was work in collaboration with General Motors at the time, and General Motors was still interested in doing research and actually finance research, because the beamline we wanted to get on was funded by General Motors. So I don't know the timely events and when it eventually happened that we got beam in. You might have talked to others and they have better recollection on how that all evolved over time, but it was a process which spread out longer than we had hoped for initially.
So when Aladdin began construction, were you involved?
No. It was there. It was pretty much there. The way there's a picture in the walkway where you see magnets in place, but if you look closer, you see there are no pipes in between. Mm-hmm. There was no real housing around the injector. So it was a surprise to me because they hired me. I had never come here to the place before, and they thought, oh, yeah, we'll do experiments by Christmas, so I came late September. And it was clear that it would never happen in that time span, and it took a few more years before anything was happening. So no, I had nothing to do with construction or layout or user interest on it. Unfortunately, I think you did not have a chance to talk with Cliff Olson,
no.
Who passed away mm-hmm. Earlier this year, who was one of the few users who got involved and had some input in how on certain decisions which nowadays sometimes look a bit strange, but for at the time when they're made were certainly well thought through. So
what are you working with today in a few years back?
In over the time we're always stuck with solids, mostly odd materials, either metals, which some people hadn't looked at, or metallic alloys, semiconductors. And in more recent time, we look at organic semiconductors, which are these pentosine molecules, which I don't know if you heard Richard talk about it some time ago, but his thesis, and then we extend whenever last 2 or 3 years we had a summer student, so they get a part of that project.
Mm-hmm.
And Casey right now is in the process to they will be grown in situ in a chamber.
Mm-hmm.
Characterized by some other means, and then we use synchrotron light for studying their electronic structure.
So can you tell me about some of your big projects that you've been working on? Are there any ones in particular, or is it a lot of little things?
No, well, they are. They are big for the time being. Then when we are kind of done with it, and done with it means normally you publish it in one way or another, and then we go on doing something else.
Okay. When I talked with Joe, he was telling me that the nature of Tantalus and Aladdin as light sources really were nothing incredibly groundbreaking or new, but he said the work that was being done, especially in solid state, was edgy.
Oh, well, the nature of this of Aladdin certainly was nothing new. Tantalus, it was, I think, really the first functioning storage ring, not much larger than the diameter of that table or two of them. Mm-hmm. But in that way it was groundbreaking, but then once they understood that, that it's kind of functioning to pile up electrons and have them just circulate and as long as they can, that was all they wanted to study before they would build and use it for some other accelerator technology thing. And so the piece was staying there. no for no good use, and 90% of the staff had left already to join efforts at Fermilab. Mm-hmm. And that's where solid state physicists came in and realized that we heard and we know there is radiation coming off, so please let us use it. So they could care less on this is a whatever quality of a storage ring or an accelerator. It doesn't need to be, it's just you need a bunch of electrons traveling around close to light speed and light comes off, and then you need a few guys who know how to use mirrors and gratings and put them together, what we then call a beamline, mm-hmm. and out comes monochromatic light, mm-hmm. in different ranges. It could be so none of these components will function equally well at visible IR, which is even lower energy than visible, or UV or X-ray or hard X-ray. So that's why you walk them out and you see different beam lines.
Yeah.
Why aren't they all alike? Some are short and bulky, some are even going back up on a platform.
Yeah.
There's always there are certain design decisions on that based on what will they be used for.
Mm-hmm.
So that's it. Yeah. Again, by default, they had to be for a long time leading edge research because there was no other place in the world.
Yeah.
So that helped them certainly a lot. But in retrospect, a lot of firsts had been done, and that's how I knew Tantalus from being a student doing work in a lab. I had never worked in one of the European synchrotron centers, but I knew Tantalus in Stoughton, Wisconsin. I didn't know there was a university attached to it.
That's actually a joke that Ed Rowe told in one of the interviews. He says, yeah, there's some professor up there who had really had nothing good to say about what was going on at Tantalus. He said he had little trouble filling up his schedule with high rollers in physics, and said he was over at a conference in Europe, and one of the guys at a German institute says, Madison, Wisconsin, is that anywhere near Stoughton?
I used to go to conferences and had the name tags printed out, University of Stoughton, Wisconsin. No, people around the world didn't know Stoughton. Why would they care about that there was a research university associated with it? Yeah, when I came, I actually wanted to live in Stoughton, and the guy who hired me, no, you really want to be in Madison. And he was right.
Yeah. Where did you move from?
When I came, I was a researcher at the Max Planck Institute in Stuttgart.
Yeah.
That's one of their premier research places for solid state physics. So.
So it was just the Tantalus ring that brought you here, or?
Yeah.
Great.
We being a laboratory user, laboratory meaning in a room, we had light sources which are homemade, special lights. They have a few very intense spectral lines, but you miss out on the continuity of the spectrum.
Great. Yeah.
And so there were great advantages to just be able to go turn a monochromator, go from 20 volt to 21.5 or whatever you want, and wow, all of a sudden life looks very differently for that solid to be excited with.
Great. So I've interviewed 6 people so far, and most of them have been here for a very, very long time, such as Walt Trusiak and Jim Taylor. So they gave me the real overlay, the whole roadmap of it. So you're the first one who has a specific study, like such as in solid state. Do you think you could tell me about the field of solid state, of some of the challenges or the projects that happened early on, starting with Tantalus?
Well, again, it was at the time, I guess when people started, it wasn't even clear what you would learn by shining light, which we call it, which is radiation of any sort, onto a solid. We knew there ought to be a conversion, though that photon, that light pulse will be absorbed and it will be converted into kinetic energy of electrons, so they will be knocked out. That was mm-hmm. a photoelectric effect. And actually that's what Einstein got his Nobel Prize for, not for all of his other fancy papers. Mm-hmm. And so people would want to measure, there was this hope if we measure the distribution of those electrons and their kinetic energy, we can actually then construct backwards on where they came from and what the binding conditions there are and the local geometry of it is, and this is what the solid, what's all about on a solid. So the difference of let's say an iron atom versus an iron atom being embedded and sitting next to his atoms of the same sort, up, left, right, up and down. So that builds up the solid, and that iron solid is very much different than the individual atom.
Yeah.
And so to study the behavior of a larger assembly of these atoms in solids, that was a major thing to do. So that's where photo emission just came in, and some of the old timers studied that and had all kind of weird interpretations of it, but some turned out to be still valid today and actually were groundbreaking. So that's what made it very attractive to come to a place like that. There were, when I was a student, so Hamburg started already with HasiLab, an extension of their huge accelerator efforts there. But when I was a student, they were tolerated to use a little bit of that light, which every accelerator has. And they were allowed to drill a hole in the tank and have a pipe going out there. So they were called parasitic users, and that's certainly something not very nice. But now, over the years, it turns out that what at that time was parasitic users are now the main users, and are actually the premier users. And there's no good reason to build any new accelerator in the world other than for the purpose of making as much radiation as you can, and as good as you can. Good now means, well, you want to bundle it down to the extreme smallest possible spot size. You give it an additional time structure to it, so you can set a clock actually within and see how electrons travel once they are impinged with a certain frequency only. So that has changed from being a parasite to being the premier user around the world. The only reason why people would still build accelerators is for that. What was initially thought is a wasteful product, which we can't avoid, but you have to live with it. So, in that sense, Stoughton was the first user-based synchrotron center in the world.
Yeah.
Not that they designed it then.
Yeah.
It just happened. It was staying around, and people want to use it.
In terms of energy, in my readings, it's seen that Aladdin's energies are pretty low relative to the other light sources. So what is the allure of having a lower energy?
Oh, well, again, that they were low here because it was initially that was not the interest to have a high energy machine. I mean, this was all they could build and maintain. That was Tantalus, was Aladdin. What's happening is, and there's this one, I don't know if Ralph Wales, he will give a talk. I used to give it to the RU student, but I thought he should do it for a change. If you accelerate an electron up to a certain energy, there will be a spectrum coming out, and it's called it's a white light spectrum, because all energy, all frequencies are involved in it. But it will eventually cut off.
Mm-hmm.
and pretty sharply. So you normally plot that versus the logarithm of the energy, of the light energy. And that cutoff depends on what is the energy of the circulating electrons. So you crank up the energy of the accelerated electrons and you follow the same path on that curve, but the cutoff goes higher and higher and higher. So it starts out basically at radio frequency, then there's this IR spectrum, the UV, soft UV, and everything. So the higher the energy of the circulating electrons is, the higher you shift that cutoff, and you are in the X-ray range of 1,000 volt, 2,000 volt, and now people have 10,000 or 100,000 volt. It opens up, well, additional spectral range and a whole bunch of very different type of experiments, mostly scattering experiments where you shine that X-ray beam onto a crystal. Depending on which crystal plane they will hit on, they scatter and you get diffraction patterns. So it's done for structural studies, mainly in pharmaceutical industry and in that area. So the when nowadays a high energy machine is 3-4 times higher the energy than what we have, which also since they have to live, they have to make a curvature, they have to get it around a corner. And that's done with conventional magnets. Mm-hmm. And we max the magnets out. So all you can do is put some loops around an iron core, and you saturate the iron core, and it has not, you can't have an iron magnet which has more than 10 kilogauss of a field or so. So those pieces, as soon as there's more energy, since the bending force is the same, they will naturally get larger. Yeah. In diameter, there's no other way about. Mm-hmm. So here you have it for a few hundred volts higher in light coming out. You need to have quite a beast of a structure there already. So the new rings are, again, by nature, they have to be so much larger to get the amount. Now the source for light in our case is that very same bending magnet. Modern machines will just use a bending magnet for what they are called for, to bend the beam. Yeah. You don't care extracting it. And they have devices which are like periodic structures of little magnets, which we have here too, but ours are compared to the modern ones are tiny. They look like, yeah, just like a toy. I mean, these are really extremely powerful devices and like 60 several hundred periods of magnets making an interference pattern. So each magnet would act like a tiny bending magnet, but they are placed in such a way that the first one will interfere with the next one and so on. So they all pile up. Their energy, which is otherwise spread out over a large angle, will be like in a pencil cone and just going straight out. And if I don't pay attention with it, you can easily melt the tank section or the magnet with that own beam. So that's not luckily nothing of that can ever happen here, so
yeah,
it's not such a big deal. But for modern machines, yeah, to turn the beam off in an organized fashion is already a delicate issue. If that would go left or right, it right away melts. So they are very powerful. So for us now, since historically people started out using the pocket size storage ring, which didn't have any soft X-rays to speak of, it had an extended UV range, the kind of science which was done, again, photo emission spectroscopy, with UV light was basically the forte of all of those people. And it turns out that it happened to be the most profitable spectrum range for that kind studies. So that was a nice turn, but it also was a reason why the new ring they built here was only slightly higher in energy, because they knew we want access to the UV part and maybe a few hundred volt, so to access a couple of typical elements. their atomic levels, and that's it. So we didn't see that there was any great future for us to be a high energy facility.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, high energy again does not mean that it's in any way or form better than the other one. It is only, well, you get more for your bang. A lot of times it's hard to live with, because you get a lot of extra which you don't want, you have to get rid of. If you just want the X-ray part, then there's some number which tells you, on okay, depending on the kinetic energy of the electrons going around, it's a critical wavelength or critical energy. So half of all the intensity is below that and half of it is above. And you have to get rid of that, which you don't want. It will dissipate on mirrors. It will be so intense that mirrors might evaporate. And you have to find ways to gradually get rid of the lower energy part.
Yeah.
Or if you want to have a beamline which uses only low energy, then the X-rays have to be absorbed somewhere. So it's much simpler to do that with a lower energy machine, because then you don't need to worry about hundreds of watts of X-ray power to be discarded off in an organized fashion. So the only real advantage of what we would call newer machines, and they are always higher energy machines, is that, again, by its nature, you can squeeze that beam better, you can bring it in a much nicer, smaller shape, what we call the emittance, so how that beam diverges and behaves. That is pretty much the only benefit, which means people could ideally study smaller samples, or larger samples, but could pick different spots, check out if they are actually homogeneous and look on the inside the same way they look on the outside, and a couple of those things. But otherwise, no, there's no other real benefit for it.
Yeah, you addressed the question that I was talking about. They said specifically for the biological studies, when all you need is infrared, that Aladdin was valuable. But in terms for solid state, what do you usually look at for the wavelength?
Well, again, we start out right away where the IR tapers off, starting out at 8-9 volts and going up to 100 or 200-300 or what.
So there's not much need for hard X-rays?
No, there isn't. No, there's absolutely not.
Right.
For a very broad range of applications, there's absolutely no need.
And what project are you working on right now?
Well, we are growing these pentosine films, which are organic molecules. And if you are able to bring these molecules in a certain crystallographic structure, so normally an organic material doesn't want to be a crystal, it's just this whatever sludge.
Yeah.
So you work hard to provide a certain substrate for it, and then okay, if everything goes well, then they kind of pile up in the same structure, like underneath. Atoms, and give them some guidance. So that whole technique is called epitaxy. So it's epitaxial growth, which kind of replicates what's underneath, even though the underneath part is not of the same sort, but it gives a template. And that's what we do at the moment.
Great.
So the idea is to grow single crystal, very thin films, single crystal films, and have a potential to be used as the future solar cells, for instance, or circuitry, and that, I guess, you will hear a bit more when Casey will talk about it, because I don't know how much you are aware of what's currently happening in the semiconductor industry or in the chip industry, where they still machine and fabricate pieces under most extreme conditions, from the purpose of standpoint of cleanliness and precision and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
So these organic molecules, in principle, and they have shown that already, they can be. You could make a solution out of this. You can print them on your inkjet printer, a circuit on a transparency foil, and people did that, and you have a transistor. So and rather than working in that extreme clean super environment with single crystal wafers, which have to be cut and processed and step by step, and people were thinking of printing that on the sort of newspaper prints.
Yeah.
And that would be a dramatic cost effectiveness and just a completely different direction to go. I forgot the number, what they say. They could print what's currently done in a year's worth of production in gallium arsenide and silicon wafer technology. They could do that in a few minutes on a rotating printing press where it spits out the newspaper or all the circuitry you ever wanted to print. So that's down the road. I mean, none of us, we're not into applied engineering or applied physics or your basic solid state physics, but to provide certain aspects of that, and this is what we do to measure the electronic properties of that material, depending how we grow it, how fast, or on what substrate we grow it, and so forth. And then these are very thin films; they're just a handful of atomic layers. Mm-hmm. It's not that you peel it off like your sticker. So, but thick enough to represent the material and very well, much better than a grown single crystal would do that. That's it.
Yeah, that gives me enough for now. Any last comments about the SRC as a whole?
I think I shouldn't comment on SRC as a whole at the moment. As you know, things are not... right now, we had hoped to attract funding for a very different animal of an accelerator, which would be that free electron laser. Again, the basic principle is the same. You generate electrons in a source, like we do down there. I don't know if they walked you through that little accelerator, a little house here where the racetrack microtron is, which is actually very unique. But of a similar nature would be electrons are produced and then accelerated in stages. Now, not by going around loops, but keep on going straight. So these would be beam lines, which the electron accelerator plus a beam line would be maybe 600 meters long or so. And again, at the very end, the piece which does make the light which you want are those undulators, periodic magnetic structures. But then those would be of the order of the length of a football field, and each magnet is only yay long, so we can calculate how many periods there are, and the gap is of the order of a millimeter or what. So you have to not only machine that extremely precise, but also get that beam over that length straight through and not being deviating left, right, or up and down of any amount, because it would bang into it and melt the whole thing down.
Yeah.
And then you have to get rid of the electrons, and they're not going back. So there's still quite some energy in them, and they have to be dumped. So it's very different. Unfortunately, we didn't get awarded with that, or the foundation decided not to go into that business right now, which it's a very different and also difficult decision for them, as well as for those who have to say in how the science should go in this country. Europeans are leading there now big time, and it might be hard to actually come close to that. Certainly in the near future, there's no way that we can see that happen. But it will be different. It will not be a place where you have 30 groups or 50 groups working. It's always a select few experiments who can work at a given time. But for that, the potential outcome would be very exciting. Highly structured, extremely short pulses, a time structure of the nature that you could follow chemical reactions.
Yeah.
With your naked eye, so to speak, while they happen, and see the products evolving and study them right there. On the other hand, the downside is that it's extremely powerful, and it most likely will change the state of matter while it's looking at it. So there are certain experiments they're planning. They are one-shot experiments, so it is every information has to be taken and then analyzed afterwards. So while our samples, they can live and can handle that light beam for months in a row, most of it. Some are radiation sensitive or soft materials, mm-hmm. tissues, and they will get damaged. But with FELs, it's a different ballgame.
Yeah.
It's a tremendous power, and due to the fact that they're also extremely collimated and very tiny beams in diameter, there's a lot of power density going in there. So they call it, it's Coulomb explosion happens. So there are particles which just fall apart because the E-fields are so strong and just...
Oh,
well, then they study the pieces which the fractures which fall along there. So it's slightly different, but it would be the most natural thing to do rather than building yet another storage ring or synchrotron center like we have on the East West Coast and in Chicago. Mm-hmm. So certainly that would not be the proper thing to do. So a Failicon facility will be built, I'm pretty sure. The question is who will finance it and where will it be?
Mm-hmm.
Could be here in the cornfield.